And welcome back to 120 Months. This is our journey through MTV's 120 Minutes. We're going month by month and just kind of paying some tribute to the songs and videos that made their appearance on one of our favorite shows on MTV. And we're going in order. So this is episode number 2, which puts us in February of 1987. One thing, you know, right off the bat, before we get into the songs, one thing I did notice already going through the, and I should mention, so going through the 120 Minutes playlist, we are getting these from a website called 120minutes.org, who has spent years archiving playlists from different sources and kind of trying to put together the history of MTV's 120 Minutes. So they have been invaluable in helping us kind of figure out what we're going to do each week or each episode. And we probably wouldn't be able to do this without them. I don't even know if we would have had the idea to do this without them. So giant shout out to them for doing all the hard work. If you go to 120minutes.org, they have virtually every show that's ever aired on MTV as far as 120 Minutes goes, and like the playlist link to the YouTube video so you can go and watch each video and kind of recreate the shows. I think as we get later on, they actually have archives of the shows themselves, so you can see like the DJ, the VJ, you know, interstitial stuff. But initially it was, there's less information, and then kind of they get more and more information as you get deeper into the run of 120 Minutes. So anyway, episode 2, February 1987, we each chose a song to go over, and then we're going to do a kind of a mystery song at the end. Starting off this week, Scott Mobley, Keith Porterfield sitting in with me today, and we're going to kick it off with Scott.
Okay, so for this one, I chose Skinny Puppy's Dig It, which aired several times throughout this month and in the month for before it and the month after it. So this was kind of a staple of 120 Minutes at the time. So Skinny Puppy is one of the sort of founding bands of the industrial movement of the 80s. This was sort of coming out hand in hand when Ministry was sort of coming along, although I think this is ahead of Ministry a little bit. Now, their paths would cross, Ministry would go a different direction, and Skinny Puppy would kind of just stay the same through all of that. But this is really, I think, ahead of its time for this kind of music at this time. So this is from their third album. The album's called Mind, the Perpetual Intercourse. This was the lead-off single of it. It was a college radio hit. You know, this kind of music is still relatively new at the time. This is a really solid example of it, though. It's maybe not the best example of this kind of music or a personal favorite of mine from Skinny Puppy, but it is a good song, and it was a hit for them. So all the hallmarks of the industrial sound are here. You know, you have like the single crunchy guitar over the electronic beat. There's Gregorian chants in it. There's samples of spoken word things, samples from movies and stuff like that. It's all in there. The song is a little slower, maybe a little droney for what maybe associated with this kind of music. But, you know, I think the interesting thing about this, when I was sort of digging down the rabbit hole, I was always a fan of these guys, but I was never like a huge, huge fan. In my head, you know, this type of music really kind of started with the Germans and then bled its way into America, and in this case, Canada. Skinny Puppy is Canadian. This song is on Skinny Puppy's third album, and this predates Front 242's Headhunter by almost 2 years. It predates Nitzareb's Joining the Chant by a good year. I really think maybe these guys were more on the forefront of this than I originally thought they were. Now, that's not to say that they weren't influenced by that stuff. You know, Germany had their bands out there at this time. You know, Front 242, even though they don't have a big hit till a couple years later, they're around at this time. But, you know, I don't think I knew anything of them at this time. So I really think maybe instead of these guys being influenced by the German industrial music, I really think they were more kind of walking hand in hand with them. This is sort of the start of it, though. You know, definitely lyrically influenced by, I think, some of the goth music of the late 70s, Bauhaus, Joy Division, that kind of stuff, with sort of the electronic beats of like a Kraftwerk or, you know, some early German electronic music. But, you know, If you're not into industrial, or you've always wanted to dabble in industrial or anything like this is a perfectly good place to start. The video is, particularly for this era of MTV and music videos in general, it's pretty good. It doesn't say much about the song, and it's more about emotional, you know, resonance or whatever, you know, trying to evoke something. It's creating a mood more than it's saying anything about the song you're listening to. But it's really good at that for this time, you know. So I really enjoyed kind of going back into this. I don't think I'd ever seen this video before. I knew the song, but I don't think I'd ever seen this video before. So this was kind of a fun watch for me, and really kind of eye-opening in the fact that I think that even though, you know, they've maybe sort of been forgotten or don't get mentioned as much as some other industrial bands, you know, Skinny Puppy really was a pioneer of this kind of music. You know, if you want to make the comparison to Ministry, Ministry's Twitch comes out about the same time as this, and it's very similar. You know, what Ministry was doing on Twitch is very similar to this music. But like I said before, Skinny Puppy just continues doing this, and Ministry goes on to become Ministry. They get a little more to the metal side of things, less to the dance side of things. But, you know, at this moment in time, 86 or so, when this album comes out, you know, Ministry and Skinny Puppy are doing about the same thing. And I always thought they were sort of copying what the German bands were doing, but I really am starting to think maybe that wasn't the case. Maybe they were all kind of growing and morphing at the same time. Because, like I said, some of the big German industrial dance hits don't come out for another 2 years after this song. So
it's kind of crazy that they don't get more acclaim or whatever word you want to say. Credit, I guess, would be just more credit for me. Like, so my entry into industrial music was a year or two after what we're talking about now, 1987. So it would have been more like 89 or 90. And of course, it was Nine Inch Nails. And Down In It was the very first song that I ever heard from Nine Inch Nails. Well, I mean, you can draw a big fat line connecting this song to Down In It. They sound like, yeah, they come from the same album, from the same, almost, you know, if you had told me, oh, this is an early Nine Inch Nails track or whatever back in the day, I'd have been like, oh yeah, obviously it is. Like, it sounds, you know, I don't know as much about where Skinny Puppy's influences came from, but I can definitely draw a line to like who they influenced after them, and that certainly runs through Nine Inch Nails. I mean, it's obvious
that, for sure. And I actually, you know, before I did any research, if you would have told me, you know, Skinny Puppy heard Front 242's Headhunter and then started writing music, I'd go, okay, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But I think it went the other way almost, you know, or at least at the same time. So yeah, and you're right, like Nine Inch Nails, particularly Pretty Hate Machine, is 100% influenced by this, you know, and probably another, a bunch of other bands just like them, but this has to be in that conversation as, you know, sort of creating that, what became Nine Inch Nails, you know.
Absolutely. I will also say, for those of you who maybe are like watching the videos along with the podcast or kind of checking stuff out, you're going to watch this video first probably, and you're going to think, why is Scott praising this video? And then you're going to watch the other three videos that we're going to talk about later. You'll be like, oh yeah, for 87, this video was actually, yeah, okay. I see your point now.
And you also, you know, you put yourself in the mindset that you were watching a video from 1987. Like, this, they still weren't really sure what videos were at that time. And so when you take that into consideration, this is a pretty solid video. It's like I said, it's all vibes, it's all, you know, creating a mood, but it's watchable. And yeah, when you watch the other videos we're going to talk about today, you're going to think this is Thriller compared to those.
This the video itself was fine. It's not bad. I know it was a little controversial when it was out at first. Apparently it got banned in a few places because of the weird letterboxing thing that it has going on, and like there's images on top and above, or above and below the letterboxed area where the main video is happening. And I guess there was some thought that there was something subversive going on in there. I watched this video after reading that, like specifically looking for that to say, okay, what was it that disturbed people about the weird stuff going on in the margins? And I had no idea what that would be. I don't have any idea why that video was considered subversive, or there was banned by certain, you know, networks or whatever. I don't get it at all. I'm not sure why that was. The video was fine. The song itself, I did not care for, as you guys probably might have said. Industrial is not necessarily my jam, so, you know, it's not probably surprising that I didn't like it. I will say, though, that if we are going to compare this song, and I really don't know anything else by Skinny Puppy, so I'm just going by this song, but if we're comparing this to either Twitch by Ministry or Pretty Hate Machine by Nine Inch Nails, this is a pale comparison. Those bands and those albums are far beyond this to my mind. And maybe Skinny Puppy, maybe this is not a representative example. Maybe they got better as they went along. But for me, no, this was not something that I particularly cared for, either the video or the song, to be perfectly honest with you.
Well, you know, that's interesting you say that, because I am, you know, I'm a pretty big Ministry fan. We just established in the past. I think this song is almost better than anything on Twitch, maybe with a couple of exceptions. But Twitch to me is still Ministry trying to figure out who they are, and Jurgensen's still doing that weird fake British accent. And I think that what's interesting about this band is that they were basically doing electronic dance music with that sort of growly vocal, which becomes the signature of industrial with all the other stuff that, you know, and industrial goes beyond them into things like Nine Inch Nails and what Ministry ends up becoming, not what Ministry is at this time. But to me, this stands up against anything on Twitch. I don't know. I know you and I kind of disagree on that album, but
yeah, I would take Over the Shoulder before I would take the song easily. I would take Angel, I think is the name of one of the other songs on Twitch that I really like. Those are like fully formed songs. To me, like, this one is more of a sketch. You know, there's stuff going on. There's a little guitar. There's a beat. But yeah, I don't know. It doesn't really strike me as being like a fully formed song.
That's where I think the front 242 comparison comes in. Like, it's a little bit more almost like samples. I mean, there's vocals, but there's some samples thrown in that. You know, it's front 242 always felt like that way, where it's just kind of like some stuff kind of getting thrown at you. And whereas like Nine Inch Nails, most of the stuff on Pretty Hate Machine are kind of more fully formed songs than this one is. Again, I don't know. There may be other songs by Skinny Puppy that are much more kind of like fully fleshed out.
There are. There's certainly some that are more... more upbeat than this, more aggressive than this. This is more of a kind of a drone, you know, for them sound wise. But I think all the characteristics of this type of music are there. Yeah, I was trying to think, like, Front 242 is a good example because that's obviously what this is. It's, you know, and like I said, I can't decide who helped who with the sound, but that sort of droning, repetitive, the rigidity of that German sound, you know, that precision of the German industrial sound or dance sound is definitely on display here. It is a little long, I guess, and it does, you're right that it doesn't, you feel like it's about to go somewhere and it never does. Kind of is the same thing for 4.5 minutes. But I don't know, being a fan of this type of music, I found it perfectly serviceable. I wouldn't put it in my top 10 Skinny Puppy songs, but it's a good one, I think. But, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe if you're not a big industrial person, maybe this isn't the place to start. Maybe there's better places to go. But I definitely think that, you know, if you want to dabble into this type of music, that Skinny Puppy is one of the bands you should look into because they're definitely at the foreground of it.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not an industrial person. So, you know, maybe that's it. And if you are, and if you want to, you know, investigate the early days of industrial, Skinny Puppy certainly is probably a good place to start. Like I said, I myself am not terribly familiar with them. This is one of the first Skinny Puppy songs I've ever heard. I've always heard the name of the band, but I never really knew anything about them. And so, you know, maybe this was not the best place for me to try to jump in on them. But yeah, not being a huge industrial fan, I can't say that this is not representative of the genre or anything. It may very well be. It's just not something that did anything for me personally. And if I were to hear this and you were to tell me, okay, so now you know something about industrial, my first thought would be, well, I probably don't like industrial music very much.
Yeah, that's fair. I also just really quickly want to mention that how weird it is that when you hear the band name Skinny Puppy, it sounds like it should. It sounds dark and sinister. But if you really break it down, Skinny Puppy, there's nothing sinister about that at all. But for some reason, it evokes that. I don't know how they did that. I don't know how they came up with the perfect name to instill you with that image and yet use two totally harmless words to do it.
I had that moment while we were talking 30 seconds ago. I actually had the image of, like, Skinny Puppy. I've never actually thought those words.
But when you heard there was a band, an industrial band called Skinny Puppy, you were like, yeah, that's a good name for an industrial band.
Yeah. Like, that did not hit me until literally like 30 seconds before you said that. I was kind of like, that is a weird name. I'm also really curious about the video thing to see why it was banned. I thought where that was going to go was Keith was going to be like, so I watched it again, you know, really closely to see why it got banned. And then I woke up on the floor and I was like in the middle of a pentagram and candles were lit. And I don't know.
I didn't know you could put that many swastikas in a video.
I lost 2 hours of my life. I'm not sure. Well, the next video we're going to talk about is a little bit of a departure from Skinny Puppy. It's a little different vibe. So we're going to dive a little bit also into, for lack of a better term, I saw this bandied about. So we'll say the Carolina sound, which was popular kind of in the mid 80s. And I think best personified by REM, although you don't really hear that term applied to them. I'm not sure that term is really applied that widely, but I did it is in like the Wikipedia page for some of the artists that surrounding this kind of nexus, which was Drive-In Studios in North Carolina, owned and operated by Mitch Easter, who was the lead singer in a band called Let's Active and was a co-producer on REM's first two albums. And then Don Dixon, who is the person we are actually going to talk about today, who co-produced those two REM albums and worked with Mitch at Drive-In Studios and was in his own band initially, a band called Arrogance in the 70s, who are just a really actually delightful, like kind of pop band for that time, like what pop music was in the late 70s. I was struggling to come up with some sort of comparison for Arrogance, because I mean I didn't have a ton of time to just like go deep, but I mean almost like kind of like Eddie Money type music, you know, just like upbeat rock that's with a good tune. Like that's what they were very good at. They ended up getting signed to Warner Brothers, so they were pretty good band. And then he ends up doing stuff solo, but he plays on numerous albums that he produced and sometimes just that he just played on. He's connected to our already favorite here at the podcast, Dump Truck, was in that orbit. So we talked about Dump Truck last week, and Don Dixon actually played on one of their albums. So this time we're talking about the name of the album it's off of is Most of the Girls Like to Dance, But Only Some of the Boys Like to. That is the name of the album. True story, by the way. And if there's any like young yeah, man, if there's any young boys out there who are thinking like, man, I can never get girls to talk to me or girls hate me, learn how to dance. All girls love to dance. Very few guys do. It'll put you in like a whole different orbit of like, it'll be like a 10-to-1 ratio. You'll have a much better time meeting a girl if you learn how to dance. The name of the song is Praying Mantis. That's the name of the song we're talking about. What to say about this song? A, it's fantastic. It's a great like mid-80s bop. It's really well written, and so it goes kind of in surprising places. It's not as simplistic as maybe it sounds. Like the first 45 seconds or so, you're kind of like, it's got this really simple bass line and played by Don Dixon, and you're just kind of like, what? But then it the song just goes like in a couple different directions, and I really actually enjoy it. I mean, it's nothing super complex. It's not one that necessarily I would, you know, put on my playlist and listen to every day, but a really fun, really great example of that Carolina sound, jangle pop, however you want to describe it. The video is at, I told you, oh man, where to start with the video? It's some green screen magic with some just totally unnecessary compositing of two different things happening at once for reasons that aren't entirely clear all the time. Don is an interesting example of probably kind of the video killed the radio star problem, where guys like Don, I think 10 years after this, were never probably going to get on MTV. So it's kind of a miracle that guys like Don and Mitch, for that matter, who were not your standard kind of, nobody is going to confuse them for Michael Hutchins, for example. I mean, they're, you know, not that they didn't have kind of the charisma, because I think they actually do have some charisma, but they just don't have the look. They don't have the vibe. They don't have that like rock star thing that you had to have to get on MTV kind of moving forward. I think this was maybe 120 minutes was the last place where you still could do this, like as we get into the 90s. But yeah, you look at Don and you're not thinking, oh, that's a rock star, but he is a talented multi-instrumentalist musician. He writes amazing music. He's produced some of the greatest albums of the 80s, especially when you talk about like REM and other bands like the DBs and Smithereens and stuff that helped kind of form the basis of what was college rock and then became alternative and indie rock. So no shade at Don Dixon for not looking like a rock star, because he absolutely is a rock star. But yeah, I enjoyed the song. The video is a fun 80s trinket to watch, I guess. I don't know how else to put it. But it was, yeah, it was a fun time to revisit something that I'm not sure if I've ever heard this particular song, but I barely remember some of Don's stuff from back in the KTXT days, and it was fun to go back and check it out.
Yeah, this one is a pretty good song. It wasn't one of my favorites, but I did like it better than I did the Skinny Puppy song, I would have to say. The video, yeah, incredibly 80s video. Like, the girl that's dancing with him at the end, like, if you, you know, were to say, what's the quintessential 80s get-up? Like, what do girls look like in the 80s? they look like that, like the stretch pants, yep. And the headband with the short hair and everything. Yeah, it was very, 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 very 80s. And I will say, though, that you mentioned Don Dixon's look. As a guy that's hair whose hair is thinning out on top, I totally have another option now. The bald on top, mullet in the back thing seems like a really killer way to go. So thanks to Don Dixon, maybe one of these days you guys will get to see me sporting the nothing on top and mullet in the back look, because I thought that was really good. I like that. I'm going to get
please.
Yeah.
We will turn this into a video podcast if you do that, my friend.
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot to add to that because I kind of agree, but this definitely is a, you know, if we talked a little on the previous episode about MTV sort of created this thing where you not only had to have a sound, but you had to have a look. And this is a perfect example of seeing that part, you know, the not having a look thing start to fade out. Like this guy beat, you know, he got this out there just in time for everyone to go, wait a minute, this guy don't look right, you know? And it's kind of a shame because I did dig this song. It's really, you know, there's nothing earth shattering about it, but it's a catchy little pop song and it's nice. And I liked it and I enjoyed it. And the video with it, it's almost like it really kind of highlights just how much that era was defined by a slickness and a look that this just doesn't have. And maybe that's why, you know, he doesn't do much beyond this as far as recording goes. You know, it's more, he becomes more of a producer, more of a behind the scenes guy, and you can kind of see why if you watch this video. But yeah, I enjoyed this one. It was a super 80s style video and a good song. I liked it.
So not knowing anything about Don Dixon until I went into this, just listening to this song, and this being the only song of his that I've heard at this point, you definitely can hear the through line from his production work, like what this song sounds like and the production on the first couple of R.E.M. albums, or if you want to say like the Smithereens, like you mentioned, some of their stuff. Yeah, I think you get a good idea of kind of what he does behind the board on this song. And like, if you like the sound of it, if you like the kind of the way it's put together and everything, I think you're going to like the things that he has produced prior to this and after it as well.
Yeah, if you have any interest at all in like R.E.M., the Smithereens, that jangle pop era, Carolina rock, Southern rock, if you want to call it that.
Don't forget Dump Truck.
Yeah, please don't forget Dump Truck. Start there. Start with Dump Truck. It all starts with Dump Truck.
It all goes back to Dump Truck.
No, listening to Don Dixon and Let's Active, which is Mitch Easter's band, you know, those are the guys that helped R.E.M. form their sound, and they're so obviously they're not going to stray that far from it, right? Like there was kind of a thing that was happening with those guys that they tapped into, and none of it wasn't radical, extreme, you know, wild production. It was actually kind of interesting reading Don Dixon describing some of the stuff they did for R.E.M., which was like, yeah, you know, we were kind of recording like conversations that were happening in the studio and like, you know, street noise and mixing it into the album. Like, you really don't hear that much on the early R.E.M. albums. Like, I wouldn't have thought, ooh, they were doing all these experimental production things. But what he also said is like, we weren't really planning it or talking about it. We were just doing everything in the moment. And that to me does speak to like the production you hear on the album, which is just this like, you know, did they do it all in one take? Probably not, but it doesn't feel like they spent hours and hours and hours, and they certainly didn't have like Pro Tools or, you know, what Logic or whatever the kids are using these days to like edit in, you know, notes from guitars and edit this thing and move. I mean, they went in and they played the instruments and they recorded them, you know, really crisply and cleanly and got these recordings that had the vitality that the bands had live. Cause that was always a big deal. When some of the people that I talked to who saw R.E.M. in the early days, it was like, man, their live shows were so fantastic. And it was really cool that Mitch and Don managed to capture that on the albums, that it had that kind of, some of that vitality did make it into the studio albums, because a lot of times that wasn't the case. And you can kind of hear that on Don's album as well, and like and Mitch's, you know, Let's Active albums. Like, they really did have a style, even though the production style doesn't jump out at you and it doesn't make itself the important thing on the album. You don't listen to it and go, ooh, I wonder who, you know, produced this. It's not that kind of thing the way like other producers who kind of put their stamp on stuff do bring their production to the forefront. But yet, I think it's really interesting that they did create kind of a template for some of these bands to follow, and each band took it and then kind of put their twist on it. But yeah, when you go back to Don's stuff and Mitch's stuff, you hear the basis for all of that, because they had those ideas, and they had a lot of talent themselves, and they had a lot of songwriting ability themselves, and some of that stuff is really, really good and stands, you know, pretty well up against, you know, the stuff like REM and Smithereens that got really much bigger.
You make a very interesting point in that, you know, this is not a production style that you're going to go, wow, listen to that production. You know, you don't say that with a lot of this stuff, but it is so pleasing to the ears to listen to. And, you know, every band you mentioned, REM, The Smithereens, this song, you know, all that stuff, it's just a rainbow in your ears when you hear it. It's so pleasing. And I think that's part of the jangle pop sound, but this, you know, the production helps with that. And so while it doesn't like stick out as production, it certainly works. It definitely has a very pleasing sound.
Given that, it's interesting to note, one of the things I read about Don Dixon when I was kind of doing a little background work on this was that he was in the running to produce Nevermind by Nirvana before Butch Vig got the job. They had actually contacted him. He was one of the guys they were thinking about. It is hard for me to get my head around the idea of that album without Butch Vig's production. If it had Don Dixon producing it instead, I cannot imagine what that album would have sounded like with Don Dixon behind the board. Yeah, that... I would actually pay money to hear him like get the tapes and take a crack at it just to see what he came up with.
I wonder if any of that happens if it's produced by someone else. And that's not a slight against Don Dixon. Just if that album doesn't sound like it does that little music revolution happen? You know, are we might be sitting here today talking about the new album that Cinderella is about to put out or something, you know?
Exactly.
Well, you know, we have a whole episode, if you go back to last season, about me explaining why Nirvana is not that important for the musical revolution. So for those of you, you know, who remember that conversation, I'm going to have to say that it would have gone just the same way. It would have been fine. It would have been great. No problem. But I would pay a significant amount of money to hear like the Don Dixon version of Nevermind. Absolutely. Because from the get-go, because you can say, well, he would have tweaked this and tweaked that. No, like when a producer is working with a band like that, it would have affected everything, the recording process, the songwriting, like everything would be different probably, especially for a band like Nirvana, who was still on the early stages. I think later on, a more mature band probably has more say, and the producer is more of a partner, an equal partner. I feel like at this time, Don Dixon probably would have kind of steered the direction that Nirvana went in, much like Butch Vig did. So I think you would have gotten something that is even more different than maybe you're kind of like thinking of, just like, well, maybe the guitar would have been louder, or no, he would have put the drums back. No, it would have been, I think, a very, very different album. It
would have been wildly different, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah, whether Nirvana would have been as big as they were, you know, I don't know. I probably not, because I mean, what are the chances that two different albums by Nirvana, you know, would have had the same effect? But the Alternative Revolution would have been exactly the same. Yeah.
The Alternative Revolution, for sure, but the grunge thing, like... I mean, we talked about this on that episode. If Smells Like Teen Spirit doesn't sound like it does, then that doesn't happen. You know, that if that is a completely different song than it is, then maybe it doesn't happen the same way. You know, maybe, you know, it probably still happens, but maybe, you know, Pearl Jam is on the cover of all the magazines instead of Nirvana or something, you know, but, or maybe a better grunge band gets launched into superstardom, who knows. But it definitely doesn't happen the way it did if that song doesn't sound the way that song sounds.
Yeah, thought experiments that unfortunately we will never ever know,
yeah.
Like the answer to, but man, wouldn't you?
What about ism is fun, isn't it?
Man, you're not kidding. All right, so a quintessential 80s song. Without a doubt, we're about to talk about one that I wasn't familiar with, but after listening to it, I can say also is definitely sounds like a quintessential 80s song. But before I turn it over to Keith, I do want to just give a quick shout out. We talked about Mitch Easter. Mitch appears in a documentary film called 35,000 Watts, The Story of College Radio. I happen to direct that film, and it happens to be available on Amazon Prime and Tubi and Google Play. So if you want to watch a documentary about college radio and hear Mitch Easter and Burtis Downs talk about REM, you can hear Joey Santiago talk about the Pixies and all kinds of fun stuff. Go check it out. Tubi, Amazon Prime, Google Play. It's called 35,000 Watts, Story of College Radio. All right. Third song in our February of 1987 120 Minutes Journey is Keith's.
Yeah, so today I'm going to talk about a song called Light of the World by the band Balaam and the Angel. Light of the World. one was a lot of fun to me because I've been aware of these guys for a while, but let me get there. So first things first, imagine, if you will, a teenage Keith Porterfield. This actually would have been my junior year in high school. When I was in school, I played on the school golf team. Not particularly well, but I did play for the school golf team. In my junior year, we got a bunch of new freshmen in on the team that year. And so, you know, we practiced off campus. We had to go, you know, to the golf course after our last class to go practice. Pretty routinely, a couple of those new freshmen would ride out to the course with me because they obviously couldn't drive, and I had a car. And so we had to get out there. So they rode with me. And what I actually had was a little Dodge Ram pickup truck. And I, just for shits and grins, I looked it up to see the current version of the biggest, baddest version of the Dodge Ram pickup truck is the Dodge Ram 3500. The little truck that I had was a Dodge Ram 50. And it looks to me that it would take the raw materials involved of about 3 Dodge Ram 50s to construct one Dodge Ram 3500. So yeah, we're talking about one of those little pickups that was popular back in the 80s. It was older, it was used, just a little starter car that my folks had gotten for me, which was nice of them, I appreciate that. But the one thing it did have going for it is that it had a pretty nice Pioneer stereo system in it that I had asked for Christmas or birthday or something and gotten installed in there. It had a cassette deck, which, you know, was critical to establishing the viability of your vehicle for a cruising option back in those days. And so on the way out to golf practice every day, we would listen to music. It was just one of our things that we did. And one day, one of those guys shows up, and he's got a tape, a new tape he wants to listen to. And it's these guys. It's Balaam and the Angel. And this was the first time I had ever heard of these guys or heard anything from them. This album was actually their second major label album. It was the one that came after the one that's got Light of the World on it. And actually, I'd always thought it was their second album. It turns out they had a self-released first album before their major label stuff. So I guess it depends on how seriously you want to take this or take that one. But this was their second album on Virgin. It was called Live Free or Die. Very much a hard rock album, I would describe it as, with a kind of a tendency toward the kind of the pop metal that was so popular back in the late 80s. It had a song on it that was called I Love the Things You Do to Me, which got a little bit of rock radio airplay. It never really broke big, but it did get some airplay. It had another song on it called I'll Show You Something Special, which was included on the soundtrack to the John Candy and Steve Martin movie Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. So this album had a little bit of traction. I bought a cassette copy of it. I liked it. Bought a cassette copy of it myself. Listened to it for however long my, you know, attention span for a new album was back in those days. Certainly shorter than it is nowadays. But then a couple of months after that, I happened to be in a mall record store in Midland, Texas, of all places, and just randomly came across a cassette copy of their first label or album for Virgin, which was called The Greatest Story Ever Told. And that's the one that's got this song, Light of the World, on it. And this one I liked even more than I liked Live Free or Die. This one was, for lack of a better way to put it, much more new wavy, a lot more synths, a lot less kind of crunchy rock guitar and more kind of the chiming, ringing, like picked guitar parts. Essentially think more Echo and the Bunnymen and a little less Motley Crue, and you'll get there. It had Light of the World on it, which is probably, has always been my favorite song on that album, really good one. Had another song on it called Day and Night, which is really good. One thing I like about Day and Night is it's one of those songs, like, you know, usually you get like an intro into a song or like a couple of instruments start and then they'll layer the other instruments on. Day and Night is one of those songs where it goes from 0 to 60, like right off the bat. There's 1 second, it's quiet. The next second, the song is fully playing, you know, fully formed. It's kind of like you fall into the song before you even realize you're listening to it. That one was really good. It's got another one called Slow Down on it that's got some synth horns on it, which I know could be a kind of a cheesy trope that was used in the 80s, but used to just fantastic effect on that song. So anyway, it was really, really good. I liked that one a lot too. Like I said, probably liked it even more than I liked Live Free or Die. Not long after that, they released their third album. It was called Days of Madness. I bought that one on CD and did not care for it at all. That was just not very good. I went and looked at the track listing of that album just to see if I could remember any of those songs, and there was not a single one of them that stood out to me at all. And so after that, I just kind of fell out of those guys. And that CD copy of Days of Madness got sold at one point or another in college when I was poor and needed beer money. I do still have the cassette copies of the other two albums. And in fact, to this day, the cassette copy of Greatest Story Ever Told is the only physical copy of that album that I have ever even seen. So, you know, like I said, I fell out of them, didn't really think much about them. Years later, this would have been back in the aughts, I guess, when I was moving and going through boxes and found a bunch of my old cassettes and found those two tapes, you know, just remembered how much I liked them, went back to the iTunes store and cherry-picked you know, some songs off those two albums. So I've had them in my music library, and occasionally over the years when I'm super shuffling the entire library, one of those songs will come up. But largely, I just had not thought about these guys in a lot of years until a couple weeks ago. And so we're looking at doing this, and I'm looking through the playlist to see what I'm going to do. And man, I was gobsmacked when I saw this band's name on the playlist. Like, I did not know that Light of the World had been a single. I did not know that there was a video for it. I did not know that was something that ever would have played on 120 minutes. I mean, you could have told me when we were first doing this that you're going to, you know, some band from your past is going to come flying out of the ether during this project and really surprise you and give me 100 guesses. And I would never have guessed Balaam and the Angel. Like, this was a complete and total surprise to me when I saw this on the playlist. So, which was great. It was fun, you know, to have this kind of come out of nowhere. So I found the song, you know, of course, I went back and listened to it, man. And the song itself is really good. I really liked it. It is kind of a mid to up-tempo rocker with one of those kind of chiming lead guitar lines that runs throughout it. Really good guitar part. The lyric is about a girl who's left home and things have not gone right for her. So she's waiting for the light of the world to shine on her and change her fate. The video itself is a pretty generic, cheesy 80s video, mainly a performance video. It looks like maybe they're supposed to be in some ruins or something. There's like shifting sands and like blocks of masonry laying around on the ground as they're, you know, strutting around playing the song with their appropriately big 80s hair with the wind blowing through it and all that stuff. So, you know, not a terrible video, not a great video either. The one thing I will say about the video is that toward the end of it, the singer, Mark Morris, appears to be wearing the puffy shirt from that one episode of Seinfeld where Jerry Seinfeld has to wear the pilot-looking shirt under the Tonight Show or whatever it is. Yeah, my going theory now is that they got that idea from this video because Mark Morris is very much wearing that shirt at the end of that video. So, yeah, good one, a pretty good video, not great. Kind of, a, like I said, generic kind of 80s video. As far as the band goes, they're a Scottish band. Mainly three brothers. There's Mark Morris, who plays bass and sings. Jim Morris, who plays guitar, Buzz Morris, who plays drums. They have had other musicians with them at various times in the past, but generally the heart of the band is just the three brothers. They are still active. They have put stuff out recently. They actually had an EP out last year, which I didn't know about, and so I haven't heard it, couldn't vouch for it. But yeah, they're still out there doing their thing. And then, of course, there's the name Balaam and the Angel. If you were thinking to yourself, that sounds like it might be a biblical reference, you would be right. That's exactly what it is. It turns out Balaam was a prophet that one of the kings hired to curse the Israelites. And while he's making this journey, he comes to a fork in the road, at which point he has a long conversation with his donkey, as one does. And the donkey advises him not to take the path in the road that is currently being protected by an angel of God. So there you get Balaam and the angel. And the clear takeaway here is if you ever happen to get random advice from a donkey, you should probably heed it because he may very well be trying to stop you from taking a thumping at the hands of an angel. So if your donkey ever starts talking to you, take it seriously.
Donkeys are the best.
They are, man. They've got your best interest in mind. But anyway, yeah, like I said, this one was fun for me, man. Just from the jaw-dropping shock of seeing this band's name on the list to the trip down memory lane and thinking about my very first vehicle where I actually first heard of these guys. So I've been listening to a lot of Balaam and the Angel over the past week or so. These guys have been in heavy rotation again for me for the first time in, like, you know, a lot of years. So, yeah, this one was awesome for me. I really enjoyed it. And I will also say that I have had this band on my radar for about 37-ish years now. And this conversation that we're having right now or about to have, I believe, is the first time that I've ever spoken with anybody about this band, except for that one dude who had their tape. He wanted to listen to the golf practice way back when. So yeah, this one was fun for me. This was Light of the World, Balaam and the Angel, played on MTV's 120 Minutes way back in February of 1987.
Well, I have thoughts. No, a caveat or two. I had never heard of this band, and I did not dig into this at all. I didn't go into the band any further. I listened to this song, I watched this video, and that's it. So I can only speak to what I heard and saw here. What I heard, and I guess my second caveat here is, there's a band from England around the same time called The Cult, And that is a band that I do not like. I have never understood their popularity, other than the fact that it's very impressive you can write that many songs about fire. I find nothing about them interesting whatsoever. 30 seconds into this song, I wrote down on the piece of paper in front of me, this sounds like The Cult. And so I kind of maybe didn't give it the chance it deserved because of that. I mean, it was funny because after I listened to it, I went to their Wikipedia page and it said that like their first big break was getting to open for The Cult. And I thought, well, they opened for them and then learned how to write guitar riffs from them because this song sounds like a Cult song. I don't know if that's what the rest of their sound is. I don't know if, you know, if that's, you know, you said that the album or this album sounds a little different from the one after it and so on and so forth. So they might've done something different, but at least this song, it just brought back horrible memories of how I feel about the Cult. So I kind of shut myself off to it. That said, you know, it's definitely a super 80s video. I love that dude, the blonde dude's hair. That's just incredible. You mentioned Motley Crue. The guys in Motley Crue would be jealous of that hair. Yeah, overall, it kind of put a sour taste in my mouth because of its similarity to the Cult, which I know isn't fair. And actually, my dislike of the Cult probably isn't fair, but it is what it is. So yeah, this one I enjoyed for the time capsule that it is, but after it was over, I felt no need whatsoever to go and listen to more of this band because I have a feeling I'm going to hear a bunch of songs that might sound like Fire Woman and that'll drive me nuts.
I didn't like it or hate it. I'm just shocked that you knew who this was, Keith. That's where, like, my brain isn't even really processing the music because I just can't believe you were exposed to this band in West Texas back at the day, and then you knew them and liked them and bought music. Like, I'm like, where did these? I've never heard of them. We didn't play them at KTXT. I just double checked; they were never on the playlist. We, like you said, we certainly have never talked about them because I did not know this band existed until we started looking at what we were going to do for this episode. I assumed that maybe you kind of knew who they were and were just going to like dip your toe in. I had no idea that you had like a history. I'm not shocked to hear that they used to be a harder band before this song because they kind of look like an 80s heavy metal band, but they don't sound like one. So I was kind of wondering if they had kind of, you know, not transitioned, but like if they had matured their music into something.
That's the Cult too. The Cult looks like a heavy metal band. It doesn't sound like one. Like I think there is a definite parallel between those two bands, you know.
Having known these guys all that time, I'd never thought about comparing them to the Cult. That's funny.
Oh, listen to the opening riff of this song. It's a Cult riff.
Yeah, man. The Cult play Born on an Angel riffs.
Yeah, I mean,
if the song was called Light of the Fire, it would be a Cult song.
My favorite part of this process with this band is I was reading the Wikipedia page and they have the best. So, you know, at the end of Wikipedia articles, they kind of start to talk about, you know, the decline of the band, if the band has in fact declined, and most, you know, as all bands do, that kind of happens. These guys' decline was summed up in one sentence at the end of their Wikipedia page, and it's one of the funniest offhanded remarks I've ever read on a Wikipedia page. Their presence was largely ignored by the time that their 1993 album, Primetime, had failed to interest record buyers. Their presence was largely ignored. People just like ignored that the band even existed. Yeah. Like, it wasn't like, well, we don't like them, or I'm not going to buy. No, we just, I can't see you.
People like walking through them on the street.
Just like they put blinders up, like, I'm not.
They're not there. I don't see them.
Maybe they were Cult fans and they were like, I'm not even going to acknowledge your existence.
We're slagging this band off. Everyone out there, please go listen to Born on an Angel. They're great.
They are not a bad band. I think if you, I don't know how to, like, if you like that particular type of music, I was struggling with it because I was like, okay, what kind of genre is this? Who does it sound like? It sounds like someone else besides the Cult, I think, that I, because I'm not really familiar with the Cult, so I don't think that would have been who it was, but I mean, I caught a little Echo and the Bunnymen there. Not a lot, but a little. But I love Echo and the Bunnymen, and I can't say that I love this. So, I mean, that's not a super strong connection. But I did hear a little of that there. Yeah, it wasn't one that I just actively disliked, but I didn't go and listen to any more of their music for what it's worth. So the video's worth checking out just for the 80s-ness of it all. And the dude's hair is magnificent, so you can't go wrong with that.
I do wonder why this band was, and we can talk about, I think in the next thing we're going to talk about, this is going to come up, you know, what made a video or a song or a band land on 120 minutes, because this one doesn't seem like that. Like, this seems much more Headbangers Ball than 120 minutes to me. So I wonder why they got lumped in with, you know, I know in 87 alternative wasn't really a thing, but they, you know, this, they, other than being relatively obscure, there's not much about this band or this video that says alternative to me, you know? So I wonder how they landed on it.
One thing I will say is that of the stuff on the album, Greatest Story Ever Told, this is probably the most overt guitar rock song on that album. Now the next one, Live Free or Die, which, you know, I also mentioned, will head much more in that direction, much more into the heavier guitar rock sound of it. But really, on this album, on Greatest Story Ever Told, this is the one serious guitar rock song on it. The rest of it is much more new wavy. Like the one I mentioned, Day and Night, is almost completely keyboard driven. So you might need to listen to the entire album to get a more of the kind of the lean toward the new wave or alternative or whatever you want to call it. Because this one is more of a straightforward rocker. But yeah, the rest of that album does have much more kind of a new wavy vibe to it. So I can see maybe getting a little bit of a different kind of feel if this song is the only thing you listen to off that album.
Yeah, and it was the only thing I heard, like I said. So that's, I have nothing to compare it to. So maybe I should dig a little deeper before I start being so mean to these guys. But it didn't feel like the kind of song or video that would be on 120 minutes. And that's saying a lot considering some of the videos that, you know, we've, like the Don Dixon video, you know, I don't know if you'd go and say that's really alternative either, but I can sort of draw that line on the big board, you know, to how he got there, association with REM or the Smithereens or whatever. I can't find it with this band, you know, unless, you know, there are people that consider the Cult an alternative band. So I guess that's maybe the connection. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely feels more in line with kind of what was happening in a certain part of the mainstream, I guess. That it wasn't just so far out of left field at that time. But that said, that band for me was super, feels super obscure. So maybe that, you know, just the obscurity of it all. But I mean, I don't know. I don't know in 87 if they were, I mean, they must have been. I just have never, ever, ever heard of this band or heard anything about this band. So, I mean, they have to be pretty obscure.
I hadn't either. And I was, you know, I was probably more into this type of music than you guys were at the time. You know, I was a little metalhead, so not that this is metal, but you know, but I this seems like the kind of thing that would have gotten on my radar somehow at that time, and it didn't. I have never even heard of these guys.
Yeah. Check out Live Free or Die. It's like I said, it is much more drifting toward the hard rock glam metal stuff that was going on in the 80s, and I can see Light of the World, you know, is kind of leaning in that direction again. But like I said, the rest of the album really isn't that way. There is a very much of a difference between those two albums as to kind of the sound. And I think, you know, the stuff they did after that, certainly on Days of Madness, and like I said, I haven't really listened to the stuff that came after that, but from what I read about it, I think that they kind of stuck in the hard rock, you know, metal genre. I think Greatest Story Ever Told was kind of the only album they ever did that kind of had that more new wavy sound to it.
So speaking of bands we've never heard of, this one I think across the board is one. And so what we've decided to do is we're going to end each episode by picking a song that none of us have ever heard or are familiar with. I think that's going to get more difficult as we get kind of deeper into our sweet spot of when we were in college radio and we were really, really just absorbing music on a daily basis. But for 87, it's been relatively easy for me. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I had never heard any of these songs before. I probably heard the Skinny Puppy song, but not in a way that I like kind of remember that specific track. I know we played Skinny Puppy at KTXT, and I was kind of enough into industrial that I probably, you know, would have played it at some point. The Don Dixon track, same thing. Maybe I heard it, but I certainly don't remember that one. I am 100% sure I never heard the Balaam and the Angels track. But so we conferred and we can certify that none of us were familiar with this next track. It's by a band called The Wallets, and the name of the track is Totally Nude, which is what kind of drew me to it initially, because I thought let's check this out. Come on, they're ready for you. The Wallets are a band, were a band, from the Twin Cities. So from the Minneapolis area, they were on Twin Tone Records, which is a relatively well-known record label. Wikipedia says experimental group. They definitely have a little bit of a novelty experimental vibe, I guess. Not that this song is way, way out of pocket or anything, but it's funky, it's groovy. It's definitely got some soul to it. Like it was unexpected in that way. I don't know what I expected. I mean, I didn't know anything about them, but it was much funkier than what I would have guessed the song would be. I kind of enjoyed it. I don't want to say amateurish because it's not. I mean, they're great musicians and it's well produced. So, I mean, amateurish isn't the right word, but it just feels like it kind of was recorded, you know, in like one or two takes and like just a nice quick riff that someone knocked out, and all of a sudden they all just started jamming to it, and the next thing you know they had this song called Totally Nude is what it feels like, you know, just like some guys that were just jamming and grooving and hit a groove and came up with this track. And it works. It's a fun song. You can definitely dance to it. The video is like the other ones, you know, of its time. It's super 80s. It had a little animation, a little bit of live, a little live vibe to it. The lead singer was kind of an interesting dude. I couldn't quite wrap my head around exactly what was going on with him. I'd like to actually dig more into that. One of the founding members is unfortunately died in 2013, so they're not even all around anymore, but they ended up becoming, two of the guys from the band ended up forming an ad agency and doing music and ads for big clients. So they kind of went kind of the Mark Mothersbaugh route, but not nearly as, not so much with the film stuff, but you know, getting into making music for ads and stuff. And I mean, that's what comes out. They're talented. They wrote some good songs. They, you know, they recorded this really cool song. There's not a lot of other information out there, but I enjoyed it. I had fun. Great fun song.
I think there's several interesting things there. You mentioned that they were called experimental, and I kind of agree with you that they're not. But I think where that comes from is, and please be certain that I am in no way comparing this band to Devo, but they do have that sound. Vocally, maybe there's something there that kind of reminds you of Devo. A little bit of the Tubes maybe kind of in there too. Those bands were considered experimental. Well, Devo is experimental. Those other bands are considered experimental at the time, and they kind of sound like them. They're not that, and they're nowhere near the geniuses that Devo are, but they kind of, your ears kind of go, hey, that kind of sounds like Devo. So I think maybe that's where that comes from, because there's nothing experimental about this music. I think that sort of loose sound that you're talking about, you know, it sounds sloppy almost, like it was recorded in the studio in one take or whatever. This was produced by Alan Toussaint. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He was a famous producer of Cajun and Zydeco music. And although it doesn't strike you as that the first time you hear it, if you listen to it a second time knowing that, you will kind of hear that sort of New Orleans Zydeco loose people marching down the street funky jazz kind of beat going on there. So I think maybe that's where that comes from. I will also say that the bass line in this song is funky, funky, funky. I love it.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I could just listen to that bass line on a loop for hours. Take the ridiculous song out of the equation. That is a great, great bass line. So, you know, we kind of talked earlier about what gets a song on 120 minutes at this time, because, you know, I think something like Skinny Puppy absolutely belongs there. Don Dixon, you can make a case for. Balaam and the Angel, I couldn't figure out how they got there. And I had the same reaction to this. I couldn't figure out how this ends up on 120 minutes because there's not really much alternative about it. But I think at this time, MTV hasn't decided what 120 minutes is yet. And so what it is the stuff we're not going to play during the day. You know, you're not going to play this video, you know, in the afternoon on a Wednesday. So you dump it in this late night block, you know, that's going on. And that's kind of where this lands. You know, you have this video, and there weren't a ton of videos at this time. So, you know, you were looking for programming, and you have this weird video and this weird song, and you plop it into this 120 minutes format. Certainly not what 120 minutes becomes. The only other thing I wanted to mention was when I actually, in this case, listened to the song before I watched the video, which I normally don't do in this, since we've been doing this, but I did in this case. And when I heard those horn breaks, I said, those are so obviously a keyboard, that horn section that's playing in the chorus of this song. I'm going to turn on this video, and there's going to be six guys standing there with trumpets faking like they're playing, you know. But they didn't do that. And if you listen to the two horn breaks in the song, one of them has the fake trumpets. The other one has what is clearly a real saxophone. And that's what's in the video, a guy playing the horn part on a keyboard and a guy playing a real saxophone. So kudos to the Wallets for not having, you know, seven guys standing there pretending they're blowing on trumpets where there are clearly no real trumpets in this song. So, yeah, I got a kick out of this one. I'm sorry, I probably talked too long about it. But I really enjoyed this. I thought it was fun.
I think it's interesting you mentioned kind of what 120 Minutes was at that time, the kind of a grab bag of just stuff that wasn't getting played otherwise. That is essentially what college radio was at that time. And at the time that we were there, you know, we had this discussion in one of the earlier episodes, you know, about the eclectic nature of the programming at college radio and how, you know, we could jump genres as long as we were kind of playing things that weren't getting played, you know, in the mainstream of that genre, you know. And it seems like 120 Minutes might have kind of started out that way. Now, as it, you know, as it goes through its evolution and gets to where it's going to get, it establishes more of a sound, perhaps. But I think these early episodes of it, just kind of looking over the playlist and stuff, I think that's kind of what's neat about these early episodes is that you do have a really seriously eclectic mix in there, and it kind of reminds me of the old college radio days. This song in particular, I was not a huge fan of. It's not bad, but it's very definitely a novelty song. You're right that the bass part is funky, but largely just a little too goofy for my tastes. I will say the one thing I did like about the video was the big like wooden or cardboard cutouts, you know, like with their heads. They put their heads on them, you know, like you see at the carnival and stuff, and like all of them like moving one way or the other and like keeping up with the cardboard cutouts as their heads, you know, go with their heads as they go one way or the other. That was kind of fun. The video in general was fun, but yeah, overall I can't say I really loved the song. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't great either.
You bring up an interesting point, and we kind of talked about this before, but I think this song would have absolutely been played on college radio. I guarantee that it was, but you know, even like for us at KTXT, we played a lot of songs that were essentially novelty songs, but the kind of novelty songs that you weren't going to hear on mainstream radio or, you know, or maybe a mainstream MTV. This definitely falls into that. I can see somebody, depending on who the music director was at the time, jumping on this. It's a funny little song, and it's, for what it's worth, there's not much going on in it, but it is catchy. It's kind of earwormy. It gets in your head a little bit, you know. So I mean, I definitely was for the hour or two after I listened to it, walking around the house going, they're totally nude, you know. It does kind of stick with you.
Yeah, it's got a little sticking power to it, and it's, yeah, it's a fun song. It's not harming anybody, you know. Speaking about 120 Minutes, I'm sure we'll continually kind of revisit what they are doing as a show and what their vibe is. And we kind of touched on this, and I was actually going to touch on it in the intro to the episode, and I got sidetracked. What's interesting to me is if you had asked me how they programmed 120 Minutes, I would have said, you know, each week for 2 hours, they, you know, they picked 20 or 22 songs or whatever that didn't get airplay or that whatever. And they picked different songs every week would have been my guess. I did not realize that they programmed 120 Minutes, at least for what I haven't looked through the whole decade that we're going to do. I've looked at 87 and 88 for the most part. I haven't really dove too deep. They program it almost like a radio station where it's, you know, because songs are coming in and out of rotation. So a song is going to get played several weeks in a row. It's almost like it goes like they had kind of an internal 120 Minutes chart or something. And it's almost like they were following that.
Those first two or three playlists that we're looking at are almost identical to each other. I
mean, they're very similar.
Yeah, there's songs that come in and out. But there's a core group of songs that show up almost every week. You know,
I had no idea. I had no idea that they did that in the beginning, and maybe they carry that throughout. I don't think they did.
I don't think so. I think as it moves on, there's so much more to choose from that it becomes more of a rotation. But yeah, at this time, they probably had 30 videos that they earmarked as for this show, and they could play 22 of them, and so the same ones are going to keep coming up over and over again. I have a feeling once you get into like maybe 92, 93, that you're going to see wildly different playlists from week to week, with a few exceptions. I mean, there's going to be, obviously, you know, if there's a really hot alternative song out there, like I was trying to think of one off the top of my head, but you know, they're going to play that every week because they know that's what the viewers want to see. I have a feeling those playlists are going to be a little more diverse than what we're seeing right now.
they might be a little more diverse, but 92, 93, right around that era was my main time of watching 120 minutes. You know, back in the day when it aired on Sunday nights, you know, Sunday night was for me was always MTV night because you got Rockumentary, you got what was called Unplugged. Then you had right before 120 minutes, you had Liquid TV. So I, you know, that was my MTV block was Sunday nights watching it. But watching those shows, there was a lot of carryover from week to week. And it did, even then, it was probably less than what you're seeing in these early playlists, but they did program it a bit like a radio station where you kind of had your hot tracks and then you had the ones that were on their way down and the ones that were bubbling up and then the what they always called their cult classics that came out of the vault. And you would see, you know, songs kind of march through there. One song, it, you know, has 3 or 4 weeks in a row where it plays, and then it's off a week, then it's back a week, then it's off a couple weeks, and then it's back. But it kind of, it has its serious run, and then it kind of starts to slowly tail off, but it's still getting played. I think all the way through, they kind of program it in that way, kind of like you're running songs through the top 35, like we did at KTXT, like through a radio station like that.
You know, now that you mentioned that, you're right, because I mentioned on a previous episode when we talked about One Hit Wonders on 35,000 Watts podcast, I talked about the song Hurdy Gurdy Man by the Butthole Surfers, and that I had seen that for the first time on 120 minutes. I very distinctly now remember telling my best friend in high school, we got to watch 120 minutes this week because you've got to see this Butthole Surfers video because I love the song so much. So yeah, you did kind of know they were going to play some of the same stuff. So yeah, now that you say that, that's probably true.
Which is kind of crazy for a 2 hour, you know, per week show. I mean, I get why they did it for the exact reason you just said, actually, the exact reason you just said, oh, I love this song. I know I'm not going to hear it until next week. I'm going to tune in next week so I can hear this song. Just like we used to do. I mean, I used to do that with like Casey Kasem's Top 40 back in the day. Like when I had the boombox and wanted to record off the radio, like that's the only time you knew for sure. Okay, probably sometime with, you wouldn't know exactly what, where on the chart it was going to be, but you knew like, okay, this song's probably in the top 15, so I can listen for this hour and a half and I'm going to get to hear this. So I had the tape ready and, you know, right. I think that's probably, but I bet that's what a lot of us did with the VCR. Same thing. Like, ooh, I know this song's going to be on. So I have the VCR ready. I'm going to watch this week. And, but yeah, if you had asked me before we started this, you know, did 120 minutes repeat songs week to week, or was it, I would have been like, nah, I don't think so. I think it was mostly like a new show every week, but definitely not. It definitely was not.
Yeah, I would have thought in my head it was as wildly eclectic as like a college radio station back in the day, you know. And yeah. It really, now that we've broken that down, it was kind of the opposite of that. It was programmed like a mainstream radio station, just with videos they weren't going to play any other time of the day.
Which is, I was thinking it's a good thing that we're doing this monthly, because if we'd done it weekly, we would have
run out of songs already.
We'd have struggled a little bit probably. So yeah, a fun set of songs. I mean, we are as firmly in the 80s as you can get. All four of these songs definitely have a different vibe, but where they all are similar is that they are very much of their time. I think in this case, sometimes we will hit songs that are not so much tied to a particular time, but I think all four of these are kind of pretty quintessential 80s type tracks. Maybe a little less so with Totally New, because it's just a funky jam. Just a weird funky jam. You could throw that out there anytime.
It's hard to put that song into any bucket, but man, is it catchy. I just liked it.
I'm so thrilled that we're doing this like mystery song that we don't know, because we're going to find some gems like that I never would have listened to or heard of or knew about. And I checked and we did not play this one on KTXT either. So this was definitely a curveball, but a lot of fun. And so yeah, that's it. February 1987. Some tracks to go check out. So again, playlists are available on 120minutes.org. We are not associated with that website. They are just some great people who do great work, like compiling all this information, putting all the playlists together. But it's super easy to go through and find songs and click right to the YouTube video and watch the videos. So if you want to do that, we definitely recommend it. And it's fun to just troll through their entire website. So go check it out. Join us again for our next episode. We'll be doing March of 1987. So that should be a lot of fun. For Scott Mobley, Keith Porterfield, my name is Michael Millard. Thanks for tuning in to 120 Months, and we will see you next time.